Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Former naval officer and airline pilot Gary Carter has used episodes from his nearly 43 years in military and civilian aviation to write Checklist Complete. His first book, Target Nimitz, was historical fiction. It came out in 2019. His second book begins with his decision to enlist in the U.S. Navy 1 week after high school graduation. Gary Carter graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy and served 25 years on active duty and worked in the Office of Secretary of Defense. After his naval service, Captain Carter flew 757s and 767s for Delta Airlines. In 2017, he joined North State Writers in Chico, which is a branch of the California Writers Club. Today, I'm going to ask Captain Carter about his book, Checklist Complete, Stories from My Life in Aviation. Gary Carter, welcome.
Thank you very much, Nancy.
Do you know, I found in my own case something that I was so grateful to you that you probably never even imagined a reader would do. And that is, I was so inspired by what you wrote that I began asking friends that I'd known for years if they had any family in military or aviation. And I learned so much about these friends. So thank you for inspiring my questions.
You're quite welcome. I'm glad it worked out that way.
I mean, people who, one woman I've known over 30 years, and her granddad was crashed in Germany during World War II, was a POW, had both his legs broken in the POW camp. Oh, just horrendous stories. And somebody else was telling me, yeah, I've got a neighbor who was in the military when he retired from Delta Airlines, a retired Delta pilot in her own neighborhood. I would never have learned these things about my friends. And I'm hoping maybe people who read your book will be inspired maybe to write about their own family.
That would be wonderful. Yeah. It would be nice to be have that inspiration go to others. So,
well, you are. I mentioned that you're a member of North State Writers Group.
Yes.
So maybe listeners say, maybe I should join that group and write about my family and their history. That I just think that's wonderful. Okay, so the title of your book, Checklist Complete, and I make a checklist nearly every day, but this is a specific kind of checklist. What do you mean by checklist?
In any form of flying, anybody would be, at any level, would get involved with checklists, and they're written because they are important and we don't want to omit something. So in this case, the phrase checklist complete really derives from a practice at Delta Airlines that when one individual reads a checklist to the other pilot, at the end of it, they say checklist complete. So that defines we've covered everything and the checklist is finalized, it's done, and we can go from there. So that's where the phrase comes from.
And so this checklist complete is part of the vocabulary, and I learned a lot reading your book about specific vocabulary. And I even thought, I'm reading a foreign language. And you even use that book, that conversation. You say that when these specialized areas are talked about, you say it sounds like a foreign language. I thought, right on, Captain. It sure did seem like a foreign language to me. So Checklist Complete is the title. Stories from My Life in Aviation. And the illustration on your cover is by an artist that those of us here in the North State are familiar with.
Right.
Who illustrated your cover?
It's Steve.
Rashad.
Steve Rashad, who's a member of North State Writers.
Yes.
And I went to him for both book covers, Target Nimitz and this one.
I recognized his style. For
yes. And I described what I wanted in kind of broad terms, and we went back and forth a few times. It didn't take long, and this is what came of it. So he's a very personable guy and an excellent artist, as you can see.
I'm a fan also.
Oh, boy, yeah.
Well, since you mentioned the cover, What did you and Steve come up with for the cover?
Since the book covers both my flying in the Navy and in Delta Airlines, I wanted to have both aircraft on there. So the bigger airplane seems to be Delta here, but I've got the aircraft, an aircraft carrier, and that they look very similar, but I'm going to tell you that's the Nimitz because I was on that one and several others. But and then, of course, a picture of the S-3 is flying there also. So
you have the aircraft carrier in the distance, and then you have two airplanes on the cover. And you mentioned the Nimitz, and that was your first book.
Yes. So a lot
Target
of this,
Nimitz.
The story in there, they're actually parallels. When I was writing that first book, I had a piece of paper that always had right beside me, not related to Target Nimitz, but ideas popped into my head and subject matters, and they ended up being chapters in Checklist Complete. So once I got done with the first one, Target
Nimitz. Which was historical fiction.
Yes. I call it
Target Nimitz.
Fiction with footnotes to explain background things. The story is fiction, but it's set in real life places, Washington, D.C., and the Persian Gulf, where I've been many times. But every once in a while, as I'm writing Target Nimitz, I think of something and say, oh, that might be interesting. And so that's where the—
Motivated you to write a second book.
Yes, came along from Checklist Complete. That's correct.
Well, people will wonder, well, if he was in the military and flying planes, he must have just gone all over the place. So people might wonder, well, where, was he born here in the North State of California? You're laughing. So and why don't you read the first page of your book?
Sure thing.
And the title of that first chapter is Beginnings.
So it starts, I arrived on this planet in Detroit, Michigan, my parents' third and last child, two sisters having preceded me. I am told we soon moved to Stoneham, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston, where my dad, a Coast Guard officer, was stationed on a ship. After his service in the Coast Guard, Dad joined State Farm Insurance, and as he advanced in his career, we moved to Cleveland, Ohio, then to Toledo, Ohio, then to Worthington, and finally to Newark, Ohio, which is about 30 miles east of Columbus. In Newark, my life began to change. In high school, I dated a girl whose brother was a plebe, or a freshman, at the United States Naval Academy. I met him over the Christmas break of my junior year. We talked about his experiences at the academy and the nuances of the application process. That spring of 1968, I applied for admission to the academy. Nearly a year later, in February of my senior year of high school, I received a rejection letter from the Naval Academy citing below minimum SAT scores as the reason for my rejection. I thought I had a fair chance of being accepted at the academy, but knew those SAT scores might hold me back. They did. I was accepted at Southern Methodist University, Miami, Ohio, in Oxford, Ohio, and Grove City College in Pennsylvania.
This is my guest, Gary Carter. He's reading from his book, Checklist Complete, Stories from My Life in Aviation. You say they wouldn't accept you in the U.S. Naval Academy.
Yeah, so, I can still remember, Nancy, my math SAT score. It was 11 points low. 11. The verbal was also below the minimums, but I don't remember that number, but I remember the math score. So what happened, though, was my basketball coach in high school, after knowing that I had received this rejection letter, I don't know how he came aware of that, but at a practice shortly thereafter, he asked me, do you still want to go to the Naval Academy? I was dismissive, to put it in polite words. Yeah. I thought, yeah, coach, yes, I do, but, you know, I've been rejected. He says, I understand. And it was very shortly thereafter I got a phone call from the freshman coach at the Naval Academy asking if he could come to Ohio.
Now, you're fairly tall as an adult. You probably were tall when you were in high school. The basketball coaches would be,
Let's... Well, that some of them were, not all that many, unfortunately. But the coach drove out from Annapolis, Maryland, to Newark, Ohio, which is just east of Columbus.
To knock on your door.
He did. And it was a Sunday, and he and my parents and I sat in the living room. I can still see this as if it happened yesterday. And I still had that a bit of an attitude because I couldn't understand why he would make that effort. And I sat there with this card in my hand. I said, "Coach, you do know that this, I've been rejected." He says, "Yeah, I'm aware of that." And I kept thinking, why doesn't anybody hear me? And that's when he introduced the idea of something I had not been aware of, and it's called the Naval Academy Prep School, Preparatory School. And it's for people similar to me or sailors and Marines who are currently in the fleet but have demonstrated good aptitude but who might need, like I did, a little bit of academic refresher and fine-tuning. And so he introduced that concept and said, why don't you give that some thought? You'd spend a year at that school after you enlist in the Navy, and more than likely, you'll get an appointment to the academy. And of course, the question goes,
well, I might mention to listeners that you're wearing blue and gold, a Naval Academy jacket, and you played basketball while you were there.
I did. I enjoyed it tremendously.
Now, you actually coached some T-ball here in the North State. T-ball. Yeah. But you were a ball player yourself, a basketball player.
Yeah. I played three sports in high school. And then at the Naval Academy, I limited to two, to basketball and track. And then I played a little bit afterwards, but that's just on, you know, base teams and whatnot while I was on active duty.
Well, one thing that, of course, I know your dad, but I liked your dad. From what you wrote about him, I thought, oh, my gosh, how many kids would want to have a dad like that? Because you said, my father, from whom I never received bad advice. And what advice was you talking about in this first chapter?
Well, we talked about the what this proposition was, this offer, if you will, this possibility. In my mind, though, I said, wait, Dad, I've won 1 year at NAPS, 4 years at
NAPS,
the Naval Academy Prep School. So 1 year there, 4 years at the academy, that's 5 years. A five-year commitment after that, that's 10 years. I'm 18. I'm going to be 28 years old before I can, you know. And he says, yes. He says, and then his comments were twofold. He says, well, that's a pretty good education at that school, number one. And he says, secondly, you're going to have a job when you graduate. And that's a pretty good job to have. Remember, this is 68, 69 now, in the spring of 69, and Vietnam War is in full swing and not a very popular event then. But I thought, you know, I could serve because I was positive toward that. Good education, pretty good job. And okay, I'll be employed for a while. That's pretty good. So he didn't actually, you know, try and convince me to do that, but he says that's not a bad option in life.
So he gave you advice that you could take it or leave it, but he had a good record.
I did comment that I kind of saw the glint in his eye a little bit.
And, oh, yeah. Like when I was graduating high school, and it was like my dad was saying, well, you can go to any college you want to as long as you go to my alma mater. So that was kind of your dad saying, you can do anything you want to as long as you.
That's pretty good.
My guest is Gary Carter. He was a captain in the U.S. Navy, now retired. His book is Checklist Complete, Stories from My Life in Aviation. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, retired Navy Captain Gary Carter, who tells stories from his life in aviation. And so you get into the Naval Academy, and applesauce plays a role, and you use the expression that you lost situational awareness.
Oh, dear.
Now, there's an example. Oh, that sounds like a foreign language. Lost situational awareness. And how in the world could applesauce play a role?
The summer for incoming freshmen, or plebes, starts in late June, early July. Mine started on the 29th of June. Not that I've...
not that you remember.
Not that I remember. The 29th of June, 1970 now. And so the Academy takes midshipmen, candidates now called plebes, from all across the country, all have different experiences, bring a whole multitude of different personalities and whatnot, and through about 2 months of training, tries to take this group and transform them into very young freshmen and plebes, is what we're called. And so part of that... is that we sit at tables in the mess hall three times a day, and during the summer you have the senior people. They're midshipmen first class. When I was there, taught the summer training program, which are seniors at the academy. Sometimes one and sometimes two would sit at the table, and we would pass the food to them, of course, because they. Rank
There's
does,
a definite hierarchy.
Oh, dear, yes.
You better follow that.
You better do it. And so we did. But the habit became, after the senior or the first-class midshipman had taken his serving, well, the rest of us are all
of whatever plebes. The dish was.
Whatever. So you'd scoop some for yourself, pass it along. And this became the habit, wherever you happen to sit there.
That was the expectation.
Yes. So now... summer ends, plebe summer's over, we're about to begin the academic year. Other midshipmen who have been out in the fleet, literally at training during the summer, have come back for school. And the table, it's the same table, but there's four seats on one side, four on this side, and two on each end. So there's 12 people sitting there. And on one end are the seniors or the firsties. Juniors are at the other end, second-class midshipmen. Across from me would be four sophomores. We call them youngsters there. And then we have four plebes, the lower form of life here.
Oh, yeah.
And at one of these meals, at the very beginning, it happened to be applesauce. And I handed the big bowl of this thing. Would the first class care for applesauce, sir? And, of course, they did. And they handed it to me. And the habit pattern of, boom, a scoop on my plate, and I got halfway turned to pass it on, and all mayhem broke because I violated.
A simple scoop of applesauce, but you did it at the wrong time. You weren't supposed to be serving yourself.
The juniors or the second class were next. The sophomores were the third class, youngsters.
And then you.
Then this... dredge of life that we call plebes, whatever's left, we divvy up between us here. And let's just say it was a torrent of disappointment there.
I think people will be surprised that there is such a hierarchy. And I wonder if that's still the case. Do you think they're still that strict?
Of course, it's been over 50 years now,
yeah.
But I'm sure... it still exists, but to what degree and about which things, it's hard to say. But here, it's the rank hath its privilege the basic underlying thing. But I use that phrase, situational awareness, which we do all the time in aviation, not just naval, but anytime, when you just kind of lose a sense of things around you momentarily.
If you make a mistake, and you lost situational awareness.
Yeah. I did.
And that's what
and
you did.
And I paid dearly for it.
Applesauce. Oh, my gosh.
Oh.
Well, people might wonder, you got married.
Yes.
But here you are in the military. How did that come about? How did you meet your wife?
Turns out my wife and I, from the seventh grade on, were in the same schools. We did junior high, 7th, 8th, and 9th, where we grew up, and then the senior high was the 10th, 11th, 12th. My phrase that I've used over the years is, for 6 years we were together, and we had maybe 6 minutes of conversation over 6 years. So we're aware of each other, but it just was all that. I went one way, she went another, and it was 8 years later when I was visiting my sister in Newark.
And how did your sister happen to know? I'm going to go ahead and give your wife's name is Debbie.
Yes.
It was and is.
Yep.
So how did your sister know Debbie? Maybe you'd like to read that from your book, how that came about. And by the way, you have lots of photographs. You have photographs of yourself and of her. So I looked at those. I would thumb back and I looked at those photos. They're just black and white photographs. But I looked at them so much of the time when I was reading your book, I would flip back and forth to these photographs.
I'll give you this one, too. I had some made. I didn't have one when
some
I
color.
Saw you.
Oh, my copy has black and white, yeah. Which is some color.
But
okay, so the title of this is, well, why don't you tell us?
Well, it was in the summer of 1977. Now, remember, we're 69 high school graduates, so it's 8 years later. I'd come back from a 8-month deployment and now was just taking some leave and or vacation time and visiting my sister in Ohio, in Newark, where she still lived. And she worked in the X-ray department at the Newark Hospital, where a Debbie Stewart lived also.
In the same occupation.
Same job, same type of thing, right. And I guess my sister said to her, do you know Gary Carter? Do you ever hear that guy? She says, yeah. And my sister got a phone number from her. I was staying at my sister's house, and she came home from work. And she says, do you know Debbie Stewart? Do you remember her from high school? I said, yeah, kind of vaguely. And if only you could know my sister. But she had this piece of paper with a phone number on it, and she puts it on the table and says, call her. And it was a head nod, an arm fold across the chest, and said, call her. And that was in June, and we were married in December.
Do you know that sounds so familiar? Because when I met my husband, it was that same. I mean, we knew right away, but we waited the longest 6 months in my life. We waited 6 months, and still people thought, well, that's kind of sudden.
You bet.
And you and Debbie got married, and you might expect that you had children. And I looked at the dedication of your book, because people, if they read this book first, they say, hey, he's got this list of names, and his wife's name is not in this list.
That's right. Yeah, the list, the dedication of the checklist complete, those names are my grandchildren. Target Nimitz is dedicated to my wife.
Your very first book you yes. dedicated to Debbie. And I might remind listeners that the title of this book we're talking about is Checklist Complete, Stories from My Life in Aviation. Now, since we talked about Debbie, something we learned from her is she apparently was a musician.
Yes.
Because she had a huge instrument.
She played, she was a pianist, and she also played the bass.
String bass?
String bass, yes.
It's not like a little piccolo
no.
or a flute.
No.
So when you graduate and you're going to be assigned overseas, what are you going to do with all your possessions? So you call that a moving experience.
Yes, yes, it was.
And that was one of the most suspenseful chapters in your book, Gary. I mean, I could see some of these other things that happen when you're flying, but I didn't expect it when you're talking about your family, how suspenseful that was. I was holding my breath.
Yeah, it was a tough day. I had orders to move from San Diego to Italy.
Italy!
And we had to do something with the string bass. And we didn't think it would survive in any type of storage situation, so we decided we're going to sell it. And Debbie found a place up in Los Angeles. We were living in San Diego, and who said that they would take the string bass thing.
Now, I think Californians are familiar with what the traffic is like in Southern California. Yeah. So you've got a to-do list for your move, and how did that? What did you do with that string bass?
Well, we decided we better take it up there, and we also combined a stop at the Long Beach Naval Base to drop off a vehicle, a Volkswagen Bug that we had, and we were going to ship that car to Italy.
Because we were told to do that.
We were allowed to ship one, and so that's the one we picked. So the idea was we'll put the string bass in the other car, and I'll drive the Volkswagen. Deb's going to drive the other car with the bass. And I have two youngsters in my back
seat. You had two very young very children. Young.
I think our daughter was 2 months old, and our son was maybe 17 months old then.
And there's a point in your story, you have all these things to remember. Okay, we've got to ship the car, we've got to get rid of the string bass, and we've got to get... But what you forgot...
We had all this stuff that anybody who's had kids knows you got to take with you, and we left it on the counter in our house. And
everything you needed to feed the babies, change the diapers, all
dear. So we went into some store on the way up. Of course, I didn't really plan on that.
So the day's getting later and later in the
day. The day is rolling on. The kids are, of course, they're so young, they're not used to any of this. It happens
they
to be
like
one
to
of those.
Sleep.
Yes. And then eat when they're awake and have their clothes changed during diapers and all that stuff. We finally get to the place and Deb's hauling in the string bass. I've got the kids with me, and we walked into this store. We're ready to leave it on consignment, and they said no. And they never called us.
Now what?
They said, we're not going to do that. And they did recommend some other store, but now time is moving on again. I've got to get the car down there to ship it to Italy. To ship it. So Deb got in her vehicle with the string bass and had directions to go to this other place. And I headed for the freeway to drive down to Long Beach and got there maybe a half an hour before closing time. Went through all the paperwork drill and left the car and the keys. And
the little Volkswagen now is going to be shipped to Italy. You left
Italy.
All that.
We're sitting on the stairs outside the building. Quitting time for the folks that work there.
They don't want to stay late for you.
No, and they didn't. And just hoping that my wife would show up in the car. And
because this was before the days of cell phones.
Oh, way before.
So you had no way of telling her or she or a way of telling
Nothing.
You how are you going to get. So that's what I'm saying about, as a reader, I'm in suspense. How in the world are they going to even meet up?
Yeah, it was a very trying day. And she had stopped for directions in some place that, well, I guess the gent was cordial, but he recommended that she want vacate that area. It didn't quite fit right there. But she got there, and we piled into that other car and stopped at Denny's, I guess. I think I mentioned that. But we had to have something to eat that day, and then finally got back. So we told the people, she told the folks where the string bass was, that we will write to you when we get a mailing address, because we don't have one.
Because you didn't even know where you're going to...
No, we didn't know anything. So it worked out.
My guest is retired U.S. Navy Captain Gary Carter, and his book is Checklist Complete, Stories from My Life in Aviation. Now, while we're on the subject of the fact that you had to stop and get baby food and diapers... I don't want to give away what happens when you get to Italy, but they have dogs that sniff out, ooh, here's a suitcase that's got something in it that shouldn't be in the suitcase. And here you are, you land in Italy, and they take you aside, and you're being arrested for smuggling. It must be drugs there, because the dog sniffed it out, and he said, okay, this guy's got something he shouldn't have.
The dog alerted on one of a bag I personally packed. I was very proud of that. I really did an artist type of job on this thing. It was perfectly done. But the dog that went through all of everybody's luggage and just happened to alert or sit right beside this one.
There's something suspicious in this suitcase.
And every one of these gentlemen around that dog saw whose bag it was. The Navy lieutenant, pilot, all that good stuff in his uniform, of course. And they said, aha, boy. So off we went. And they wouldn't even let me carry the bag into the
room. Oh, yeah. They don't want you to touch it.
Oh, don't touch that.
You can't touch it.
But each of the clasps to open it had a 3-tumbler code. And, of course, it locked. And they're trying to figure out, because they don't want me to touch the bag, how are we going to do that? And finally, somebody said, I guess it's okay.
So finally they let you.
I set the code.
Yeah.
I couldn't open it. They have to open it. Uh-huh. I just set the right code in for them. And, of course, popped it open. And there, I might add, perfectly packed.
Oh, yeah. Very neatly.
Were Pampers. And they looked at each other, and they weren't going to accept that. Of course, they went to the default position, in my mind at least, where they said, aha, the drugs must be
hidden in
the
diapers.
And so they went through the whole thing. And now we have a mound from my masterpiece that it's all just flowing over where, and they can't find anything. So they said, okay. And then one of them, in the most insincere tone you can possibly imagine, says, do you want any help redoing your bag? And I said, no, thank you. You know, and off we went. So it's a wonderful way to start.
Yeah, but after the start, though, you really liked being in Italy. You would like to have stayed longer. And I can just imagine how beautiful that was.
It was.
Gaeta, Italy, is not something that most tourists even have ever heard of. They've heard of Naples.
Right.
But
it's roughly halfway between Naples and Rome. And it's on the west coast. Beautiful town. Great people.
You really liked the Italians.
We really did. And so when it came time, I was a 2-year assignment there, and you know the end when it's happening. And so I started informally checking around, and we have what we call detailers in the Navy. There's the people that write orders for individuals. And I got a hold of one, the one that was going to handle my orders. And it was kind of a short conversation. You said, Gary, we can't do that. You need to move on and get back to the States.
My guest is Gary Carter. He is a local writer who has written Checklist Complete. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and I'm back with my guest, Gary Carter, and he served in the U.S. Navy as a pilot, and then he also, when he retired from naval service, was a pilot for Delta Airlines. One of the stories that you tell, because in the very title you wrote, Stories from My Life in Aviation, and these stories are just full of suspense and humor. And one of the things that I found actually funny was how could a paperclip play a role in one of your adventures? A paperclip, for Pete's sake. How did that come about?
You might say it was a career-saving event.
Oh, yeah. A simple paperclip.
Yeah. The event here is I was the executive officer, the number two person in a squadron, on a S-3 Viking squadron.
You might be a little more specific because S-3, I don't know what that is.
Well, it was preceded by a propeller-driven aircraft called an S-2. The S-3 came out. In fact, it first came into the Navy in 1974. It's an anti-submarine warfare plane. It's designed to try
and... Anti-submarine. And this is a jet now?
Yes.
And okay.
It seats four in the aircraft, and sometimes we only fly with two in the front if we're not on a particular anti-submarine warfare mission. So we were embarked on the USS Carl Vinson, and we were at sea for, I think it's going to be a 6 to 7 week at sea period. The ship was well off the coast of Washington State and heading to the west. The ship had established a beach detachment at an Air Force base called McCord Air Force Base, which is near Tacoma, Washington. And I was asked to fly an S-3 from the ship into McCord to pick up a bunch of parts that had been pre-positioned there, aircraft parts for the air wing, and mail for the ship. So I selected a young gent from the squadron, and we launched for...
Was he happy to be chosen?
I think so because, in the thinking at the time, you get a night off the ship and you get to do something a little bit different. So
off you go.
Off we go, land, met the detachment officer in charge, said, we'll load this thing up tomorrow and we'll see you then. So we went off, came back in the morning, fully loaded this plane up. The S-3 has a... once you enter the aircraft, it had a bunch of equipment. It looked like it was, you could say it was on shelves. It's easy to take one off, unplug a few things, and then put a new one on. It was made maintenance often very easy. But it also then had space in there, and we filled that up with bags of mail and various parts that for the different aircraft in our air wing.
Part of your assignment to
right.
deliver.
So we put all that carefully in there because we're going to land back on the ship, and an arrested landing, you come to a stop very quickly, and we didn't want all that stuff to come flying forward. So we put some time and effort into making sure it was all secure back there. Just when we're ready to leave, in fact, we had both engines started, and we were just moving, and the officer in charge runs out to the airplane, starts running at us and waving his hands. And I looked, Ron is the gent beside me, and I said, we looked at each other, and we kind of said to each other, I wonder if he's going to stop or if he's going to come right to the door. The entrance hatch on the S-3 is right in front of the engine on one side. It's a number two engine. Jet engines have a lot, even at idle, they're very strong intake pressure there. So I could just see what was going to happen, so I shut off that engine. Ron got out, and he opened up the hatch. This guy came in and says, I was the XO, the executive officer. He says, XO, there's a part that got mishandled, and it's sitting at Bremerton National Airport. We're in Tacoma. Bremerton's about...
Tacoma has all the facilities you need for
everything.
Landing and taking off in Tacoma, but...
Yeah,
now he wants you to go to this other airport.
Which is, I would say, similar, maybe a little smaller than Chico Airport.
Yeah, Chico Airport.
Which has this place, though, didn't even have a control tower. It was, it's just a nice, small, little civilian airfield. Ron and I got out some books that we kept on the aircraft to see how long the runway was, whether or not it could support the weight of the aircraft. And, of course, like most civilian fields, it had its own – well, it didn't have a tower, but it had what we call a common radio frequency that anybody who wanted to go in there or out would get on that frequency. Problem here
is – Something else we learned, too, is that I never thought about all the factors that play a role in when you have an airplane, the requirements for the things that you have to consider, air temperature. I even made a list of those. But what are some of the factors that have to be taken into account when you're flying into and out of an airport?
In this case, or in any case, the length of the runway, the field elevation, the broadly you could consider what we call density altitude, which is how the airport elevation, the temperature, and then to a lesser degree, atmospheric pressure and humidity are factors, all affecting the performance of the engine.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the engine.
Mm-hmm. So in this case, very conveniently and fortunately, but kind of rarely, it in the northwest up there, that day was crystal clear and very chilly. So cold, to generalize, is good. Engines operate better there. So
it's cold, and you had an idea about the altitude.
We looked
that
up.
Other factors.
That's not too bad. The runway, I later was reminded, it was 6,000 feet long. That's a pretty good length of runway, turns out. So we again looked at the charts. Not only can we do we have enough to land, but it's important to be able to take off. So we were okay there. The radio's a problem, though, because those radios had what we call VHF radios, very high frequency. The S3 had UHF. It's a different frequency range. So we couldn't talk to anyone.
That would be scary.
Yeah, it's a little unnerving. I didn't mention earlier, but it's certainly appropriate here to say it, that Ron, who was not a pilot but was a naval flight officer, however, had on his own time and expense acquired a private pilot's license. So it was comforting to me. I had a private pilot's license, too, before I started naval training, flight training. But I had somebody with me who understood this environment. So we discussed how we're going to enter and how we're going to land and take off and all that. And that was a factor that told me, yes, it helped compel me to do this. So that jet left the aircraft. We started up the engine, flew up to Bremerton and landed safely, trying not to, for example, do any wear and tear on the brakes.
And you said they had no control tower.
No. Nobody. And oddly, the whole time we were there, which is going to take a little while, it turns out, but we didn't see another aircraft taxi or land. It was very odd. We parked, and for the second time this day, here comes somebody out of a building, and he is so excited. Now, he was an enlisted sailor. He had his Dixie cup, you know, type hat on. He took that off, thankfully. I applaud that in his hand so it doesn't get ingested into something. But he's running right toward the airplane again. And we have that same look, and we're shaking our heads. So I had to turn off the number 2 engine again. Ron went out. This guy's so happy to see us. And he gave Ron the part that was in question, the whole reason for going there. This thing weighed less than half a pound. It felt like maybe it was a transistor in there or something. I don't know what it was.
But your whole assignment was to pick up this little part in this little airport.
Well, the assignment really was to go to McCord. This is a little side stop that nobody knows about, which is going to be a problem here because after Ron got back in and we're ready to start up the engine again, it wouldn't start.
Here you are stuck in this airport, which you didn't know you were going to have to go to. And the engine had started before. You have engine 1, engine 2. Engine 2 had started a little bit before, and now it won't start.
It won't start. So Ron looks over at me. You know, he's a very junior, relatively inexperienced officer. And, of course, the way I look at it, he had perfect cover. He's got the XO of the squadron.
It won't be his fault.
And nothing's going to happen to him. So, and answer, what I did was I said, Ron, you stay here. We'll keep number 1 turning still. I went in to make a phone call. Luckily, through the years, I had you meet a lot of folks, and the naval aviation community in any type of plane, if you're around it enough, you get to know people. So I called the training squadron that was in San Diego from Bremerton, and I got a master chief, an E-9, that's the highest enlisted rank, answered the phone. We knew each other. Hey, I said, this is Commander Carter, you know, blah, 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 blah. And he said, hey, XO, how are you doing? I said, well, I got a problem. And I told him, I'm at Bremerton National Airport. And of course, well, what are you doing there? And I go through the story. I said, my engine won't start. He says, oh, I got the right guy. And he hands the phone off to a senior chief. That's an E-8, one below. I know him. He knows me. We have previous association. Go through the whole thing again. And he says, could you get a paperclip? And I wish people could see the look on my face that I'm showing.
Imagine.
Yeah, oh, my goodness. I opened up a drawer at this place.
How low-tech can you get?
Yeah. I say, I've got one. And he says, okay, unfold that thing and make it in the shape of a U. Do you know where the starter connects in the engine? I say, yes, I do. And he says, you take this thing and put it across the prongs of the cannon plug. Cannon plug is one that might have 7, 8, 9, many holes in it, and there's prongs, and it fits on there. Take that apart, take the paper clip, have the other guy put the start switch up, you'll be good to go. We did all that. Nothing happened. Back in, same phone number, Master Chief. Oh, yeah, you want to talk to Senior Chief? Yep, back to him. He said, what's wrong? I said, well, I put the paper clip right across the prong. He said, no. That's what I heard. He said, take the other end of the cannon plug where the holes are, where the prongs go into. And I said, wait a minute, there's I don't know, 8, 7, I don't know how many different prongs. He says, doesn't matter. Pick any two, stick it in there. That's what the U is for. That will short circuit the system and it will start. It did. I never flew again for the rest of my career in the Navy without a paperclip in my flight suit. That thing started up. It got the thing buttoned up. Ron and I taxied out right to the bitter end of the runway using everything possible. Nice, clear, cold day. Whew, off we went. We had 1,600-mile trip to go. We couldn't get to the ship, but we went to some place which I'd never heard of called Cold Bay, Alaska. Stopped there, shut both engines down, refueled, got a bite to eat. I looked at Ron. I said, I got a paperclip. If we need it, we'll see what happens. He says, okay. They both started. Didn't have it, you know. Then we fly out to where the ship is supposed to be. Another 1,500-mile trip out over nowhere. Of course, it's just the Pacific Ocean. And we have the correct radio frequency in to listen, and we can't see anybody, and we don't hear anything. So finally, I just broadcast and said, basically, hey, we're here. And they had turned off all electronic equipment. They were practicing what they call MCON, emissions control procedures. They turned some stuff on and off. We made it back.
And there are so many stories in your book that we didn't even get to. But you, at the back of your book, you have lifetime maxims. And I really... I looked at this. It was kind of my checklist. For example, when you were one of your adventures, you said you didn't tell the members in the airplane, don't press eject. You didn't want to use that word eject because they would hear eject. And I just yesterday heard somebody say, don't forget to breathe. And I was thinking, if that were me, I think I would say, remember to breathe.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Take the word not out of these sentences. So I think people will get a kick out of your maxims. And just, like I say, so many stories that we didn't even get to. So I hope listeners will be inspired to ask some family members about their experiences. They might be surprised, because I certainly have been. And maybe they would like to join you in the North State Writers Group. Thank you so much.
We'd welcome them. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Thank you. My guest has been retired U.S. Navy Captain Gary Carter. His book is Checklist Complete, Stories from My Life in Aviation. And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Looking for the joy. How can there be joy when blood seeps into the pure white of snow, when innocents are called terrorists and citizens are silenced by bullets? Remember the rich blue of sky and the gentle pink of the sunset, the geese on the wing, and the egret standing as still as the body on the ground. How can we remember joy as windows shatter, doors are beaten down, a nurse life-saving others, killed by a government who feels no shame, weakly a smile wiped still by bullets, a mother's grief, a motherless son? Witnesses record the sounds as his body, silenced, breathes no more. Can joy survive the gunfire, the screams of anguish and confusion, in the midst of death, the aggression of accusations and ready justifications, the buzz of the hummingbird wings, the sound of stories spun like spider webs? Those in power work to surround and kill the truth as they weave new lies. Joy, the remnant of another time, seeing the breeze in the treetops and the grasses sway, the sun giving hope in the chilly morning, ripening the buds, preparing for bursting leaves, reminding us of the breath of the fresh rose, the strawberry warmed by the sun. Pine trees exhale into the woods. Bears stretch their limbs and baskets of new life are laid. How does joy and new birth make sense of the untimely deaths? Julie Hort.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.